From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, two cover stories. The first, unraveling the LIBOR scandal.
It's just impossible to imagine financial corruption scandal that's bigger in scope than this.
And then, the minimum wage is hovering close to its lowest value in modern times.
In today's dollars, the minimum wage in 1968 was $10.34 an hour. And now it's $7.25 an hour.
We'll take a look at getting the maximum out of the minimum wage. Also, the big money arms race between the super PACs, how artificial reverb changed rock and roll forever 65 years ago, and the movie that actor Gabriel Macht could watch a million times.
My parents got the biggest kick out of me coming in there like pretending I was Tim Curry as Frankenfurter.
Plus, the unlikely hero of D-Day and the enduring legacy of the girl from Ipanema. Also, jazz bassist Linda Oh, that's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered.
Hello.
Hello, Mark.
Hello there.
How you doing, man?
Not so bad.
Where are you?
I'm sitting in a basement apartment in Brooklyn. The AC is off, and it's still remarkably cool.
So Mark Blythe is an economist. He was just visiting Brooklyn. He normally teaches at Brown University in Providence, and we called him up. Okay, you have a computer in front of you, right?
I do indeed.
To ask him to explain a number and why we should care about that number. Okay, can you do me a favor and look up the latest LIBOR rates?
Surely. So I'm just going to Google daily LIBOR, and I'm getting to globalrates.com, and I got them all here. I got all 15 contracts that are
okay, there. What Mark is doing, he is doing something banks all over the world do every day. They check out these numbers from LIBOR. It stands for the London Interbank Offered Rate.
These are the rates on different loan categories and maturities denominated in different currencies.
In simple language, LIBOR sets about 150 interest rates a day. Rates like what a bank would pay to borrow dollars for a fixed period of time, or the interest rates at which huge multinational banks can borrow money from one another.
And it's a whole series of five decimal numbers going from 0.23786.
And those numbers, they determine the global flow of billions of dollars, maybe even the interest rate in your savings account or your home mortgage. LIBOR comes up with those numbers based on what a handful of representatives from the biggest banks in London say they should be.
This is so-called reference rate. So basically what happens is the British Bankers Association says to them, "Hello, chaps. I was wondering if you could tell us how much it would cost to borrow some money from you for, let's say, 24 hours or a month or 3 months or whatever it happens to be." And they report all this at 11 o'clock every day. Then two guys in a room, and apparently it really is two guys in a room, sit down and work out the mean of this by lobbing off the top bids, the top 25%, and the low bids on the bottom 25%. And what you're left with when you average it out is the LIBOR number for a specific loan of a specific duration.
You do a good English accent.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's LIBOR. Maybe you've never heard of it. I certainly hadn't until a week ago, but this week changed all of that.
The latest banking scandal in Britain has forced a top CEO to quit this morning. Bob Diamond is the second top official to be forced out at Barclays.
Pressure is mounting on Barclays after it admitted to manipulating interest rates.
Regulators in the U.S. and Britain fined the bank nearly $500 million for manipulating lending rates.
That was news this week that Barclays, Britain's second largest bank, admitted to lying deliberately about its LIBOR numbers from 2005 to 2009. Sometimes Barclays would manipulate the numbers to make it easier to lend money. Other times they'd make it harder, all to make sure that Barclays would come out ahead. Now, in its wake, the bank's CEO, Bob Diamond, resigned this past week. The company agreed to pay $455 million in fines to regulators in the UK and in the US. And now, several other banks, including American ones, are under investigation for doing the same thing. Our cover story today, why the LIBOR scandal matters here and how Barclays Bank is just the tip of the iceberg. So, how did investigators uncover all of this? Emails sent between Barclays bankers who submit the LIBOR rates and the bank's own traders, people who stand to make more money depending on how they can manipulate those rates. Mark, do you have this email in front of you?
Yeah, I got it on a phone.
Okay.
You want to play the trader, I'll play the submitter?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, go for it.
This is from March 13th, 2006. The trader writes an email to the submitter. He says, "Hey, the big day has arrived. As always, any help would be greatly appreciated." And then the submitter helps him, and the trader from Barclays writes to him and says, hey, when I retire and write a book about this business, your name will be written in golden letters.
And having just sent in a false bid, or something that, if it's not false, at least is in my friend's interest, I reply back, I would prefer this not to be in any book.
I bet he would. March 27th, 2005, you are the submitter, you're going to have to come in a bit late. I want to be the traitor here, and I say, Noonish, who's going to put my low fixings in? Ha, 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 ha.
And the submitter says, don't worry about it, I'll get someone else to do it.
April 7th, 2006. This is a trader. He's asking for, a low submission. And he writes, he says, he promises, coffees will be coming your way either way, just to say thank you for your help.
And I would respond, of course, done for you, big boy.
And these are all real. These are all real emails.
Oh, there's another one about Bollinger champagne floating around, all the rest of it. Yep.
Yeah, we'll crack open a bottle of Bollinger for you.
Mm-hmm.
So then you might say, well, what's the big deal about a bunch of bankers in London manipulating some obscure interest rates?
Well, the big deal about it is, even if the attempts to manipulate this aren't successful, you're still talking about the reference rate for by which practically every contract in the world, from the most complex derivative to the credit card in your pocket, is actually set. Your car loan's probably set in reference to LIBOR. Your mortgage is set in reference to LIBOR, subprimes in particular. So if these guys were pushing this rate around, then there's a case for manipulation. If they were doing it with lots of guys in other banks at the same time, it's collusion, if not conspiracy.
So you're telling me that the bankers in London are basically determining the interest rates of some of the loans that I hold?
Oh, yeah. Those bankers in London are doing this not just for you, they're doing it right around the world. LIBOR is a benchmark standard.
What was the point of the Revolutionary War?
Well, the point was you guys got it wrong. You were just meant to shut up and pay your taxes, and you've never been very good at that.
Well, to help us sort through the rubble of the LIBOR scandal, I'm joined by Matt Taibbi. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hello.
Also with me here in our studios in Washington is Simon Johnson, a professor at MIT, a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Simon, welcome to you.
Nice to be with you.
Matt, let me start with you. Before the holiday this week, you posted a blog post, and your headline was, "Why is nobody freaking out about the LIBOR banking scandal?" Why should people in the U.S. really care about this or worry about this?
Because the scale is just mind-boggling. You know, every town and municipality in America probably has investment holdings that are pegged to LIBOR. I think the Wall Street Journal calculated $800 trillion of financial products. So if there's cartel-style corruption that is affecting the LIBOR rate, it's just impossible to imagine a financial corruption scandal that's bigger in scope than this.
Simon Johnson, you and others have written that the problem is not just LIBOR, but it's a culture of what you call lie more.
That's right. The expression is from Dennis Kelleher of Better Markets. But lie more as the strategy, lying as a business model, lying as a systematic approach to reporting on interest rates.
I mean, essentially, you're saying that the banks have had an incentive to lie, to cook the books.
They've had an incentive and an opportunity, both in terms of the structure of how the British Banking Association runs the reporting system on which they base the calculation of LIBOR, but also the lack of internal controls within Barclays. And presumably, other banks have also either had failure of internal controls or complicit senior management or both.
This is what Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, had to say about the whole culture of the financial sector this past week.
From excessive levels of compensation to shoddy treatment of customers, to a deceitful manipulation of one of the most important interest rates, we can see that we need a real change in the culture of the industry.
That's Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, essentially the equivalent of our Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke. Matt Taibbi, you've written a lot about the culture of the industry, and we saw this past week with this LIBOR scandal, emails from traders at Barclays asking their colleagues to manipulate borrowing rates, emails that said, dude, I owe you big time, I'm opening a bottle of Bollinger. One trader in his daily calendar, his diary, wrote, ask for a high 6-month fix, as if to remind himself that he's got to ask his colleagues to cheat for him.
He needs a post-it note to remind himself to rig world interest rates. That's like melting Antarctica to water your lawn, which is another reason I think that this scandal hasn't quite gotten the press it deserves yet, because it's so hard to contemplate.
Let me ask you sort of a counterintuitive question to both of you. If the banks were artificially keeping interest rates down, could one make the argument that there's a silver lining there, that it actually kept borrowing costs lower for consumers and for other, you know, small business owners and so on?
Well, this is, I think, what the rationale was of Barclays, they released this email the other day that suggested they were actually quasi-instructed by the Bank of England to do this, because during that crisis period in fall of 2008, everybody was worried about the appearance of financial soundness at these banks. But the problem is, where does it end? When the government can just sort of step in and change numbers to suit itself, or the banks can do that, then we're not really dealing with a free market anymore. And if they're going to make that argument, I don't think that's going to hold up.
Simon?
Pensioners, everyone who has saved, spent their life saving, has put money into any kind of product that's linked to a fixed interest rate. You may not even know that that's where your pension's coming from, but it typically is. All of those people are losing when interest rates are manipulated down. I would also say and emphasize the people in charge of overseeing how banks operated have failed us again on an enormous scale. So I worry a great deal about the impact on confidence in the banking system.
How do you resolve this? I mean, right now, as it stands, the banks are still arbitrarily determining these borrowing rates. Is there a way to create a mechanism, a formula to make this authentic and transparent and not rigged?
This, to me, is analogous to something I just wrote about, which was there was a scandal that kind of surfaced in the last few years about systematic rigging of municipal bond service auctions. And what they did in that case is they just sort of gave semi-substantial fines to the banks involved. But it wasn't nearly enough to alter the behavior of the companies. And what I'm worried about in this case is that that's what's going to happen here. I mean, they gave Barclays a record fine, $450 million. But that's not going to be enough to change the way these banks do business. You know, there have to be high-level criminal prosecutions for them to really make changes. And I worry that that's not going to happen.
Simon, changes?
Well, criminal prosecutions, where appropriate, would absolutely begin the process of changing the culture here. But I think Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, said it very well recently. He said, quote, "My word is my LIBOR is dead." In other words, LIBOR should not be based on what the banker tells you, in principle, he or she could borrow at. It should be based on actual transaction data. That's what we do in other financial markets. It should be exactly the same thing for interest rate. Real transaction data without rigging, without cheating, without any kind of cartel operation.
That's economist Simon Johnson of MIT. His recent book on the national debt is called White House Burning. Simon, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And thanks also to Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine, who joined us from our New York bureau. His most recent book is called Griftopia. It tells the story of the financial crisis. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. 100 years ago, 1912, Massachusetts became the first place in America to introduce a minimum wage. It would take another quarter century before a national minimum wage was set in 1938.
The Congress passed a Fair Labor Standards Act, what we call the Wages and Hours Bill.
That year, President Franklin Roosevelt made it law that any hourly worker had to be paid at least 25 cents an hour.
Except perhaps for the Social Security Act, it is the most far-reaching program, the most far-sighted program for the benefit of workers that has ever been adopted here or in any other country.
It was revolutionary. Very few countries had anything like it. And every few years, the federal minimum wage would go up, helping millions of Americans inch closer to a middle-class lifestyle. But something changed in the early 1970s. Since that time, the minimum wage has fallen by around 25% in real dollars. So, for example, today, the minimum wage is $7.25. But in 1968, you'd make the equivalent of $10 an hour in today's money.
Think about the people that in 1968 got the minimum wage. And then think about the group today, that it's basically the same group, but they have 30% less buying power.
That's Senator Tom Harkin. He's a Democrat from Iowa, and he's introduced a bill in Congress to raise the minimum wage to $9.80. We'll hear more from him in a moment, and more about the possibilities and pitfalls of pushing for an increase. Our cover story, getting the maximum from the minimum wage. Now, the first thing we wanted to find out was what it takes to raise a family on minimum wage.
My name is Margaret Lewis, and I am a transporter for the disabled at O'Hare Airport.
Margaret Lewis is 50. She lives on the south side of Chicago with her four kids. And compared to a lot of hourly workers, she's lucky. In Illinois, the minimum wage is a dollar higher than the national rate. And every morning at 1 a.m., Margaret Lewis rolls out of bed to start the workday. She's one of the people at O'Hare who pushes passengers in wheelchairs through the terminals.
One thing I like about it, it keeps me in good health, legs are strong, I can keep up with these teenagers that I have.
Margaret lives in one of the roughest parts of Chicago's South Side, Inglewood. Her modest three-bedroom apartment sits right under the shadow of the Dan Ryan Expressway. All four of her children who live at home are in school, and that's the reason she took the early shift.
So that I will be home to make sure that homework is done and food is done.
Now, Margaret Lewis works full-time, and she works hard, always on her feet. And even with tips, her annual salary, about $18,000, is still about $10,000 below the U.S. poverty level for a household her size. It takes an entire paycheck, she told us, just to cover back-to-school shoes for the kids. Clothes come from thrift shops, food stamps help a lot, and her monthly rent, $850.
I never could pay a whole rent. And what I have made out with the landlord, we do the little janitor work around, keep the grass cut. When the winter, we make sure the porch and stuff is shoveled.
In the past year, two people have been killed on her block. And so in the morning, when her kids have to get themselves off to school, she worries.
Every day. The last shooting was a few months ago, and unfortunately it happened at the time my son was leaving the block going to school when the bullets rang out. And I'm all the way at O'Hare Airport. That was the scariest moment of my life. He was real shooken up, so, you know, it's not the greatest neighborhood. But if I move, it'll be in the neighborhood of this surrounding as well, because that's where the most affordable rent that fits my budget will be in.
A $1 increase an hour would mean more than $2,000 a year for someone like Margaret Lewis.
I'll be able to buy new things, not all the time use things. It might not sound a lot to most people, but to me, that much in a year, it would make a big difference in my household.
In 2008, President Obama campaigned on a promise to raise the minimum wage. He didn't. Mitt Romney has said he supports pegging it to inflation, but he recently backtracked, and he now opposes an increase. According to the Economic Policy Institute, if Senator Tom Harkin has his way, and the minimum wage were actually raised to $9.80 an hour, it would increase wages for 30 million Americans, 10% of the country.
Look at it this way. In today's dollars, the minimum wage in 1968 was $10.34 an hour, and now it's $7.25 an hour. So that's how big it's fallen.
So you want to increase it about 35%. What impact do you think that will have on hourly wage earners?
Well, I think what it will do is it will give hourly wage earners more spending money, and they will be then able to buy more goods for their family and send their kids to schools. And that's what helps make our economy go. When people are making the minimum wage, basically they're spending just about all their money because they don't have much left. And so if you give them a raise, it means more for our gross domestic product. We've estimated that if you raise that minimum wage to about $10 an hour, it'll be $25 billion more in our gross domestic product, 100,000 more jobs, and 28 million Americans would get a raise. Quite frankly, I don't believe anyone should be in poverty if they have a job. If my proposal went through, a $15,000 a year worker would be making $20,000 a year. You know, $5,000 a year is significant to someone in that category. May not get them out of poverty, but it sure makes life better.
Are you concerned that by doing that, it could actually cost jobs, it could actually increase unemployment in the country?
There's absolutely no proof for that. In fact, just the opposite. We have found that when minimum wages were increased, quite frankly, employment actually went up because we found that people get a higher minimum wage. As I said, they spend more money and they get the local economy going. And that has a great multiplier effect.
What do you think the outlook is for this bill, Senator Harkin? I mean, when do you think it could, if ever, could it go to the floor for a debate?
Well, I'm not Pollyannish about it in an election year like this year. I do believe we should bring it up. I don't think the Republicans would ever let it go through, but I think the people of America ought to know where we stand on an issue as fundamental as keeping the minimum wage up at a level that provides a decent support for people that are very poor.
That's Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa. Now, opponents of his bill do point to jobs, that with such high unemployment, an increase in the minimum wage will actually make it worse. That's what Joe Olivo argues. He owns a small printing press in New Jersey, and he employs 47 people. And I asked Olivo how a higher minimum wage would affect him.
It has the effect of lifting the entire wage scale up, because what happens is an employee that's been here for maybe 3 years and has more experience than the person making an entry-level wage, they will rightfully want more for their experience and seniority. So what it does to me as a business owner, by pushing up the entire wage scale, it increases my expenses, and I can either, A, increase my revenues, which is very difficult in this economy, or find ways either to cut my expenses by cutting employees, not hiring a new employee, or finding ways to bring in new automation or technology to decrease the amount of employees that I need. So it really hurts my current employees. Then it also prevents me from bringing on new employees because the entry-level wage, it increases, and I really have to think hard.
18 states have set minimum wage rates slightly higher than the national level. 4 states actually have exemptions and even lower minimums. A full-time job earning $7.25 an hour adds up to less than $16,000 a year. That's substantially lower than the federal poverty rate. Bill Dunkelberg is the chief economist for the National Federation of Independent Businesses. That's a group that lobbies against increasing the minimum wage. I asked him whether he believes it's possible to raise a family on that salary.
No, but you're assuming that all these minimum wage workers are raising families, and if you go check the census data, you don't find that to be the case. Most minimum wage workers are temporary workers, part-time workers, and most of minimum wage workers come from above median income families. So, you know, this is not a deal in which you have to live in New York City on $15,000 and raise a family of four, which is the kind of story that supporters of the minimum wage like to tell.
One argument for increasing the federal minimum wage is that it would actually, you know, help small businesses because it would put more money in employees' pockets, money that they would then spend on consumer goods.
Look, every dollar a minimum wage worker gets comes out of somebody's pocket. It either comes out of the employer's pocket or customers who have to pay higher prices to cover the increase in the cost. Logically, that cannot be the case. There cannot be some magical amount of new money that appears and is suddenly spent in a local community.
Do you believe there should be no minimum wage at all?
I think that would probably be a good idea. The idea, argument against that, of course, is that suddenly we'll cut all the wages. Well, that's not true. Everybody who's employed now at whatever wage they're employed at, whether it's the minimum wage or 10 an hour or 50 an hour or whatever, are there because they bring that kind of value to the firm. So they're not going to lose their jobs. But how about the people who aren't quite so skilled? How about the high school dropouts, et cetera? They could get a job at 5 an hour or 3 an hour or whatever and learn on-the-job skills. You know, now they stand on the street corner, they get older, but they do not get more employable. So let anybody get a job, prove themselves at any wage, and of course, if you're a good worker, you can always get a better job.
Your argument is it's better for somebody to earn $2 or $3 an hour rather than to be a panhandler, for example.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's not the job of businesses to turn themselves into social service providers and pay wages in excess of the value brought to the firm. I mean, they'll all go bankrupt. We do have something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, where we provide supplemental incomes to people who are working but need more money because of the number of children they have, or they a single parent, or whatever. So, if, you know, it's not the job of businesses to guarantee people's income, but if we as a society choose to help people out like that, then we find them through programs like that.
That's Bill Dunkelberg from the National Federation of Independent Businesses. By the way, in 1950, it took about 50 hours of minimum wage work to pay the average rent. Today, it takes more than 100 hours. Let's turn out of politics and super PACs, those outside political groups that could spend $1 billion by November. Reporter Robert Draper recently wrote about how conservative-leaning super PACs are paving the way. We asked him just how far ahead the Republican groups are.
Well ahead of the Democrats. What they project is that they will be raising about $800 million. By contrast, Priorities USA, the pro-Obama super PAC, pledges to raise $100 million.
Now, the best-known super PAC is American Crossroads, the one founded by Republican operative Karl Rove. Robert Draper was curious to find out more about the biggest pro-Democrat group. It's called Priorities USA, and it was founded by a former White House staffer named Bill Burton.
Priorities USA is a super PAC formed by Bill Burton as well as Rahm Emanuel's right-hand man for many years, Sean Sweeney. Sweeney and Burton are best friends, and they both left the White House about the same time in February of 2011. Sweeney left because Rahm Emanuel was running for mayor. Burton left because he had tried to succeed Robert Gibbs and become press secretary of the White House, did not win in that contest, and though others at the White House wanted him to stick around, he decided to try something new. At that point in time, fully a year after the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, a number of super PACs had cropped up as a direct result of that decision, but none on the Democratic side. And concern was mounting in a lot of corners that this sort of unilateral disarmament that had in large part been promulgated by President Obama, who had such an expressed distaste for these super PACs, was going to have major consequences in the 2012 election. So Burton and Sweeney figured this was a void they would fill and were not deterred by the fact that they'd never done anything like this before, that these guys were messaging and campaign strategy guys, not guys who went around raising money from rich people.
Democrats have been accused of taking a fairly sanctimonious position when it comes to unlimited, unregulated money in politics. But is that all done with a bit of a wink and a nod? Do you think that really the White House is just delighted about this?
They're delighted now, but they honestly were not before. I mean, Obama had staked out a position that these super PACs were bad. And I think he read correctly, for the most part, that a lot of Democrats would feel that way. But by December of 2011, when the gross disparity between what the Republicans were raising in terms of super PAC monies and what Priorities USA was raising, when that became apparent to the Obama campaign, then the campaign manager, Jim Messina, showed those numbers to fellow advisor David Axelrod, who said, we've got to take this to the president. And it was at that time that Obama finally said, we're not going to unilaterally disarm and go forth and prosper your Priorities USA.
You paint a picture of Bill Burton. He is a combative, a nice guy, but he likes the fight. What is his game plan? What is their strategy to fight Mitt Romney?
Given that they can't match the Republicans dollar for dollar, what they believe they've got to do, the only way that they can be helpful in the attempt to reelect Barack Obama, is to frame Romney in a very negative light, to basically tell a story of Romney that would repel voters from him. What they came across, so what they decided sort of after a bit of trial and error, was a narrative based on Romney's time at Bain Capital, the private equity group. And their thinking behind this is not just that all of these people who are laid off by as a result of certain acquisitions of companies by Bain, but it was even more effective as a means of explaining who Mitt Romney is. Because Romney's message he's been telling people over and over is, I understand how the economy works.
I'm a businessman.
Right. I'm a businessman. I understand how the economy works. And the rejoinder in these ads that Priorities USA has put out is implicitly that he does know how the economy works, but he's only interested in making it work for rich guys like himself.
Is there any evidence that these ads so far have been effective?
Yes. Yeah, they're not anecdotal. There's pretty hard statistical evidence that both sides have seen that in swing states, and amongst independent voters, and these are in fact, you know, the very places and the very groups that Priorities happens to be targeting, since they don't have a whole lot of money and have to be very precise in their targeting, that Romney's unfavorables have gone up. And those people who've been polled and have been interviewed about this have in fact cited, well, it's terrible what he did laying off, you know, these people. And so, yeah, it's clear that it's having effect. Now, will it ultimately have that much of an effect? Will they manage to turn that many voters, especially given that in the fall, these hundreds of millions of dollars from the Republican side will be unleashed in terms of negative attacks on Obama? Will their ability to shake up swing voters in these particularly targeted areas make much of a difference? We'll have to see.
That's Robert Draper. His article on the super PAC race can be found in tomorrow's issue of the New York Times Magazine. Robert, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Now to a story about an innovation that forever changed popular music. And it starts with this song. It's called Peg O' My Heart. It's by a group called The Harmonix. And 65 years ago, this summer, it was the song of the summer. And why?
With the advent of recording technology, there had been, you know, various techniques of how to create, you know, a sense of physical space.
That's writer William Weir. He wrote about this song and what makes it so special for The Atlantic. And it has to do with this right here. That sound, that kind of echo, like the music is being played in a different room, That was brand new. And how did the harmonics do it?
The engineer, Bill Putnam, at the studio, he did it by putting a loudspeaker and a microphone in the studio's bathroom, and it created this great, deep, rich echo or a reverb.
Reverb, it's a kind of sound reflection that's more of a ringing than the repetition of an echo. And before this song was recorded, no one ever bothered to create reverb this way.
He used it in a way that was very artistic. It goes beyond just what the physical space, but it lent it sort of an eerie, almost hypnotic effect to it.
And it was such a fresh sound in 1947 that a few years later, by the 1950s, everyone was trying to figure out new ways to do it.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell.
Sam Phillips didn't invent it, but he's the one who made it famous, specifically with Elvis Presley.
How did he do it?
He had an Ampex machine with two playback heads. One played the original sound, and a second one played it just milliseconds after that, and it created this very echoey sound.
And then you had some other musicians, like not too long after that, trying to record in an aquarium.
It was Duane Eddy, the king of twang, and he found this 2,000-gallon water tank in a scrapyard. And what he and his engineer did was they put a microphone in one end of the tank and a loudspeaker in the other. It would create this great swirling, rich reverb sound.
So at what point did American music kind of hit max reverb?
I'm going to say the 60s is when you had guys like Dick Dale and the Surf Guitarists.
You mean that wasn't done for Pulp Fiction?
No, that was Misery Lou, that was 1963. Had all these surf guitar bands coming out, and everyone wanted to get a Fender reverb amp and get that great spring reverb sound.
So this is actually, you write that this is the oldest and most universal sound effect in music. You think of like Gregorian chants.
Exactly. And that's a good example of, you know, for the most part, for most of history, we were at the mercy of echo in the sense that composers and musicians were writing for cathedrals that had reverberation times of 6, 8, 10 seconds. That's a sense of where reverb actually kind of created a style of music.
You write a lot about Fleet Foxes. This is like they are like the darling of indie rock. So
and,
they
yeah,
actually are big users of reverb.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Big
and
users.
Why are they so into it? What does it do for their music?
I've read that they said that they wanted to achieve the transcendence of religious music, albeit without, you know, the religion of the music. And when you hear it, it does have a very spiritual sound to it. In a way, it suggests a presence beyond ourselves. You know, when you shout hello into a stairwell and you hear your voice ringing for a few seconds afterward, it's hard not to think of something beyond.
And you can do that all in post-production, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we can actually take this conversation now and add some reverb to parts of it.
Yeah, it sounds better, doesn't it?
It sounds better. It sounds richer. I think I think we should do all of our interviews in reverb.
That's a good idea.
That's William Weir. He lives in New Haven, Connecticut. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. All summer long, we've been asking actors, writers, and directors about the movies that they never get tired of watching, including this one from one of the stars of the TV show Suits.
My name is Gabriel Macht. I'm an actor, and the movie I've seen a million times is a Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Michael Rennie was ill the day the earth stood still.
Directed by Jim Sharman and starring Tim Curry as Dr. Frankenfurter, Susan Sarandon as Janet Weiss, Barry Bostwick as Brad Majors, and written by Richard O'Brien, who also plays the part of Riff Raff.
Science fiction.
I grew up in New York till I was 5, and I remember going to see Annie and
some musicals as a kid, and I remember my parents being somewhat okay with us watching Rocky Horror Picture Show, which it boggles my mind that they allowed me to watch it.
Hey, Janet.
Yes, Brad.
I've got something to say.
Uh-huh.
Rocky Horrors is a musical with incredible lyrics about a very wholesome young couple who get a flat tire in the middle of the night, a rainy night.
What was the bang?
It must have a blowout.
And come upon this house where all they want to do is use their phone to get someone to pick them up. Riff Raff, you know, he opens the door.
Hello.
And then Brad's like, I'm Brad Majors.
This is my fiancée, Janet Weiss. I wonder if you might help us. You see, our car broke down a few miles up the road.
I think perhaps you better come inside.
Come inside.
You're too kind.
I mean, I just love that moment. And then they start into the time war. I mean, that's a huge number.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll.
And they're brought into this world of transsexuals and transvestites.
How'd you do, I?
I think when Tim Curry says, come up to the lab.
Come up to the lab.
See what's on the slab.
See what's on the slab. I see you shiver with anticipation.
You know, he's just amazing.
I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania.
You know, my father's an actor, and a bunch of his actor friends and writers, they'd come over to the house, and we'd always sort of bombard them with our little shows. And so my parents just got the biggest kick out of me coming in there, like pretending I was Tim Curry as Frankenfurter, prancing around, climbing the bookcase, walking down the dining room table as like this sweet transvestite. And, you know, a couple of years ago, someone asked me, like, why'd you become an actor? And it's because someone clapped.
By the light of the night, it'll all seem all right.
That's actor Gabriel Macht talking about the movie that he could watch a million times, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Macht currently stars on the USA TV show Suits. It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Some of the heroes of the Normandy invasion in 1944, better known as D-Day, are legion. Eisenhower, General Monty, the 101st, the 82nd, and so on. But how about Juan Pujol Garcia? Without him, D-Day may have been a disaster. Author Stephen Talty tells Pujol's story in his new book. It's called Agent Garbo, the brilliant, eccentric secret agent who tricked Hitler and saved D-Day. And this is who Juan Pujol Garcia was.
He was an ex-chicken farmer. He'd failed as a soldier in the Spanish Civil War. He was managing a one-star dump hotel in Madrid. The one talent he did have was this sort of raw imagination, and he'd had that really since childhood.
As you write, he is essentially this nobody. He's running a one-star hotel in Madrid. He has these grand visions of doing something. So he goes to the British Embassy at the outbreak of the Second World War, and he offers to be a spy for them, and they basically laugh him off.
Yeah, he walked in and he sort of said grandly, I offer you my services. And the response was, your services of what? I mean, he was... He had no background. He had no resume to offer. So they sort of laughed at him, basically, and passed him from secretary to assistant consul. Eventually, when they didn't pay any attention to him, his plans veered towards espionage. So he knew that he had to go to the Germans first, establish himself as a German operative, and then turn double agent.
So after being sort of spurned by the British, he goes to the Germans. He says, I am a Nazi sympathizer. I want to be an agent on your behalf. Of course, he really wanted to be a double agent, but he felt he had to prove this to the Brits. He managed to forge a diplomatic passport, which you write, convinced the Germans that he was the real deal. What did the Germans do at that point? They say, okay, you're our man, go to London?
They did. But of course, he didn't have really the ability to get to London. So he just went back to Lisbon, pretended he was in London, a place he'd never been to. He didn't even speak the English language. And he started on this sort of self-made, imaginary espionage career.
He was writing false dispatches about what was happening in London.
He would go to a movie and there would be a a newsreel and he would see some kind of ship, and he would be able to produce sort of a huge description of what the ship was capable of, what its secret compartments held, things like that.
All the while writing them from Lisbon,
taking great risks. I mean, had the Germans made one check of his sources, he would have ended up in a concentration camp. I mean, Lisbon was accessible to the Germans.
In Britain, some of these communications were intercepted, and he was so believable, you write, that the British counterintelligence started looking for this guy. They launched a manhunt in the UK trying to find Juan Pujol Garcia.
Right. There were supposed to be no Nazi spies, no Axis spies in England at the time. And all of a sudden, on the airwaves comes this voice saying, there's an armada heading for Malta to relieve it. And the British were terrified. They're like, someone has sneaked past our lines and someone is in the heart of the beast, because his reports were so believable even to people in the country that he was supposed to be spying on.
How did he eventually convince the British that he was on their side and that they should actually use him, they should sponsor him?
Well, it was really that report on the armada going to Malta. This was something that Pujol just created out of thin air, gave very precise details about what was happening. And the British were able to see that the Germans responded with full force. They sent Italian fighter planes. They sent warships to intercept this imaginary armada. So it told the British that this guy had power, that he was believed. And that was very important to them. So they brought him to London, they smuggled him in, and they debriefed him.
And that's where they gave him the name Garbo.
Right, the greatest actor in the world.
And he was set to work right away. They started to help him create a false network of spies. And this is what he did. He created fake imaginary spies all over Britain. What kind of information does he start to feed to the Germans?
At the beginning, he's just reporting movements of different battalions in England, increasing confidence in himself, and giving them what he considers chicken feed, little bits of military information. At the beginning, were completely true. These were non-essential facts that the British felt that they could pass on. And slowly, over time, they began to mix that chicken feed with imaginary information that they wanted the Germans to believe. So the ratio of true to false declined over time. And at the end, he was pretty much giving them 100% fantasies.
I'm speaking with writer Stephen Talty. His new book is called Agent Garbo, the brilliant, eccentric secret agent who tricked Hitler and saved D-Day. He became incredibly valuable in the run-up to the D-Day invasions, to the point where you write, I mean, Eisenhower was aware of him. The high command knew of this guy. What kind of information was he sending to the Germans in the run-up to D-Day?
He was creating a million-man army called FUSAG, which was going to be sort of the alternative army to the real one that landed at Normandy. Normandy would be presented as a feint, provocative first move to get the Germans to attack it, while the real invasion was going to come up the coast at Calais. So Pujol was the point of the spear in getting that information across to Hitler. He was giving them reports of huge movements of troops and battalions across England, all pointing towards Dover, which was the natural launching point for an invasion of Calais. There were fake destroyers being created out of rubber, fake airfields being cut into the English countryside and where real planes landed. So he was sort of the screenwriter for an epic film that was being played out right across England.
What's amazing is that 2 months after the Normandy invasion, the Germans maintained 2 armored divisions and 19 infantry divisions in Calais waiting for that second attack.
Absolutely. I mean, General Eisenhower asked for 48 hours to keep the 15th Army out of his hair. That was really the standard of success for Garbo. But weeks and months later, those troops were just waiting for the real invasion, waiting for Garbo's army to show up.
What's absolutely amazing to me is that, as you write, the Germans did not discover this deception until after the war. On July 29th, 1944, they awarded him an Iron Cross for his service to Nazi Germany.
Yes, they did. I mean, it was a source of endless amusement to Garbo and his handlers, but it was really proof of their success. And he kept that for the rest of his life. I mean, he was so proud of that. That was something that was really supposed to be given to frontline combatants, and here they were breaking their own rules to give it to a spy that couldn't be named elsewhere in their records, but that they felt had been a loyal, fanatical supporter of the Nazis, when in fact he'd really been the opposite.
The irony, of course, is just 5 months later in another ceremony, but this one in Britain, he was awarded an MBE, a member of the British Empire, for his real service to the Allied efforts.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of another spy especially who received high accolades really from both sides.
What happened to Juan Pujol Garcia after the war?
It's kind of a tragic story. He was afraid that the Nazis were going to mount reprisals against his family. His wife had really gotten sick of the war in London, gotten sick of England, and the war really broke them up. So he fled to Venezuela to hide out. She went with him for a couple years, but afterwards took the kids back to Madrid. They had three small children by that time. And Pujol lost touch with them. They grew up believing the cover story that he put out, that he had died in Angola or Mozambique in 1948. You know, they believed that for 3 decades, that their father was dead when he was alive and well and living in Venezuela. So he paid a very high price for his service.
He died in 1988 in Venezuela. He was running a small gift shop, but he was recognized very shortly before he died.
Right. A guy named Nigel West, who's really the dean of British spy writers, made it his life's work, really, to track down the real Garbo. He found him in Venezuela, brought him back for the 40th anniversary of D-Day, and he walked those beaches where he'd saved so many thousands of lives. And there was a group of veterans who were standing there with their wives and families, and they turned and embraced, and Pujol, you know, cried his eyes out. But it was really the only thing that meant anything to him. He was really in it to save liberty, but also to save lives.
That's Stephen Talty. His new book is called Agent Garbo, the brilliant, eccentric secret agent who tricked Hitler and saved D-Day. Stephen, thanks so much.
Great to be here.
Here is the second most recorded song in pop history. The first, incidentally, is Yesterday by the Beatles. But the second one, this one, it's been recorded by everyone from Frank Sinatra
tall and tan and young and lovely,
to Amy Winehouse
from Ipanema goes walking at
to Michael Bolton.
When she passes, each one she passes goes
and many, many more. Here's writer Tom Vincent Guerra.
Diana Krall, the Yale Witham Proofs. And I see that Mike Tyson recently had his version.
When she passes, each one she passes, say, ah.
Iron Mike Tyson on a Brazilian variety show. The song, of course, is Girl from Ipanema. It was written 50 years ago this summer in 1962. Tom Vincent Guerra recently wrote about the song's strange endurance and the story behind this one, the original.
The story is actually fairly straightforward. The composers Tom Jobim and Vinicius Moraes were working on a musical called Blimp, of all things, in Brazil. And they were stuck on a song and needed some sort of inspiration, so they went down to a bar in the Ipanema district of Rio. According to myth, lovely young woman passed by and inspired them to write a whole new song on cocktail napkins. They knew this woman by sight. She used to come to the bar often to buy cigarettes for her mother or just on her way to the sea. And that set the song in a whole new direction.
This is the Brazilian singer João Gilberto. Now, you don't hear this in many versions of the song. It's because an American music publisher, Lou Levy, wanted to release the song in the U.S., and so he asked that it include English language lyrics. But then the finished version was too long.
He basically lopped off Gilberto's Portuguese, leaving just the English by Gilberto's wife, Astrid.
And tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes
She, Astrid, was apparently, like, she was barely experienced as a singer, and some people didn't think that she actually sounded great, but somehow it was perfect. It was this perfect voice to sing the song.
I agree. It's her very lack of professionalism that makes the song so appealing, because it sounds exotic, as I put it, out of reach, like the girl herself, out of the touch of mortal man.
You know what else I love about this song?
Mm-hmm.
That it's this great song that is enduring, and then... And then it's a great elevator music. Like, who can forget that scene in Blues Brothers?
Yes, looking back at the clip, there are Aykroyd and Belushi, while about 500 cops, state troopers, firemen, peace officers are on their tail trying to nail them, and they're very calmly ascending as the girl from Ipanema is softly playing in the background.
It's actually a perfect moment. It's like that perfect moment. You know, as we mentioned, this has been sung by everybody. I mean, Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis and Ella Fitzgerald.
Mm.
What explains its endurance? What explains the fact that this is the second most recorded pop song of all time?
You know, it's a seductive song. It instantly conjures up peace, tranquility, and frankly, sex. Somehow, it transcends those elements to become even more universal than just its components.
That's Tom Vinciguerra. He wrote about the girl from Ipanema for the Wall Street Journal this week. And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Ele quer cantar. Senhoras e senhores, ao piano Daniel Jobim, cantando no caldeirão, Mike Tyson, Garota de Ipanema, The Girl from Ipanema. Up to you.
One, two, three, four. Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and it's time now for music. This is jazz bassist and bandleader Linda Oh. Now, like many jazz musicians, she makes her home in New York City, but her journey to get there has been like few before her. Linda Oh was born in Malaysia to Chinese parents, but as a toddler, she moved with her family to Australia, which back then wasn't a very welcoming place for Asian immigrants. Oh started taking piano lessons there when she was four. Music was just a hobby back then, but once her uncle strapped a bass guitar around her neck, that's when she fell in love. Linda Oh's new album is called Initial Here. She got started playing bass in both jazz and rock bands all over her hometown of Perth in Western Australia.
It's actually a really great scene over there. I got to see a lot of great musicians, and that inspired me to actually go to college and take up upright bass and pursue it as a career.
What did your parents think about that? Would they have preferred that you just stuck with piano?
Well, yeah, it was a difficult time, I guess. Both my sisters, I have two older sisters, and they're both actually doctors. And also just the typical maybe Asian family mentality was that music was something more of a backup, I guess, you know, something to help us grow as people, but not really seen as a profession. So when I decided to become a musician, and not only that, become a jazz musician, my parents, they flipped out a little bit, but, you know, they're actually really cool about it now.
Your parents are Chinese, Malaysian Chinese, and you were born there.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a track on this record called Desert Island Dream, and it is about the journey that your family took from Malaysia to Australia.
Pretty much. Well, throughout the generations from southern China through to Malaysia, a lot of Chinese ended up moving from China to Thailand and Malaysia, in many cases involuntarily. And some of my family moved through from China through to Thailand, kind of in that situation, you know.
We're talking about the Cultural Revolution era.
Pretty much, yeah. And hearing the stories of what my family has been through, it's kind of inspiring to know that I'm playing jazz music now as a living, knowing what my grandmothers went through.
Is part of that journey that your parents made and that you made as a child. How old were you?
I was three.
You were three, so you don't even remember it, probably.
My very first memory was the day that we moved from Malaysia to Australia. I just remember waking up in the morning and everything was in boxes and then moving to Perth in Western Australia during winter time. And Perth doesn't get too cold, but in comparison to Malaysia, it was a huge shift, you know. And it was a tough time for my family too, like it is for any family that immigrates. At the time, there was still a lot of negative sentiment towards immigrants in general
in Australia.
And I see a lot of similarities between Australia and America about immigration, legal immigration. And for a long time, Australia did have a white Australia policy, and it made it very difficult for people who weren't white or of European descent to actually immigrate. So it was a tough time.
It must have been tough for your parents. I mean, they probably didn't speak English very well.
Well, my father was actually, it was relatively easy just because he was educated in Brisbane. But for my mother, it was very difficult.
Completely different world.
Completely. And for my mother, she spent her whole time, her whole life basically, in this one city, pretty much Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And she speaks Cantonese, Mandarin, Hokkien, a little bit of Hindi and Malay, and then moving to Australia where her accent was quite thick. She could speak English, but it was broken, you know, and seeing the way she was treated, it kind of made me a little bit angry when I was growing up, you know.
I'm speaking with jazz bassist and songwriter Linda Oh. Her new record is called Initial Here. Linda, before you set out to write this record, I read that that you went to Malaysia and you went to China.
Yeah, I went to Shanghai, which is where my grandmother is from. And I learnt Mandarin when I was a small child. Mm. But at the time when we were growing up in Perth, I guess there weren't that many Asian kids in our school. And we didn't have that many Asian friends. So the idea of learning Mandarin was kind of a little bit pointless to us at the time because we were working so hard to integrate. You know,
you wanted to be Australian.
Pretty much. And my parents took us to church. We tried lots of different things to make sure that we felt settled, you know. But now, as an adult, looking back on it, it's a real shame, you know, that we didn't get more into Mandarin. So it's been awesome to actually go back. I've been taking classes at NYU to actually get back to my roots and study Mandarin. And it was great to go to Shanghai to actually put that into practice. 不要哭，小妹妹。
Talk about lyrics. On one track, you have Mandarin.
Yeah. I wrote one tune called Thicker Than Water, and that was in dedication to my mother and my grandmothers. It's half in Mandarin, half in English, and I had a fabulous singer, Jen Shu. These lyrics all refer to small things to do with my grandmothers and my mother's lives.
So you've got this record out, and presumably it shows up in the mail to an address in Perth where your parents live, and they open it up, and they must be so proud of you.
They are. They're not avid jazz listeners, so a lot of it they, you know, kind of goes a bit over their head. But I think just the fact that I stuck with it despite skepticism, and yeah, I think they are pretty proud.
It's Linda Oh. She's a jazz bassist and a band leader. Her new record is called Initial Here, and you can check out a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Linda Oh, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks.
For the week ending July 8th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show was directed by Walter Ray Watson. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Brett Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Amy Held, and Beenish Ahmed. Michael Tomsic is our intern, Mathoni Waturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.